Well, guys, here it is. The first episode of Mythic Connections Unleashed. There are so many lenses through which we can view the world. Mythology is like a kind of lens as well. Each mythology, each story, provides a new framework or set of parameters through which we can see and comprehend the world around us. The thing is, as we're viewing the world through these lenses, we sometimes forget that we have them on. Many modern people are consumed with their obligations instead. Our bills, our family, our jobs, materialism. Those ties cause us to forget that the lenses are there. And we go back to subconscious programming of what we're taught to believe and how we were taught to act. But what if for a moment you remembered that you had on these lenses, these glasses, and what if you took them off, only to discover there's many more lenses around you to grasp, all of them shedding a small piece of the big picture? What if all of us were fed limited worldviews, made to forget that we had the lenses on, and it was to keep us safe by the lens we love, to keep us docile for those who sought control and influence over us, to keep us working and to keep us motivated? All of us up until this point have seen the world in the way that we have been taught to see it, by our parents, by our families, by our friends, by our schools, and by our jobs. I want this to be a place where we can put those nuances, at least temporarily, behind us to explore other lenses, other mythologies, other implications of the stories that we've grown acculturated to in plain sight. Now, that being said, let's take a closer look into how we've been indoctrinated before we move into the actual myths. We're going to delve into some education systems, acculturation, and indoctrination in order to better understand how myths are actually a tool for change in the world. Arguably, one of the largest points of indoctrination begins in our schools. We have the most neuroplasticity in childhood, so it makes sense. If you want to gain control over a particular narrative, if you want to popularize or depopularize ideas within your group of people, it makes sense to target the classroom. Christian missionaries of all shapes, colors, and sizes ventured across the world into indigenous communities, and they would build schools to reach people beyond the actual book of the Bible with their teachings. It was a form of cultural exposure and indoctrination. So it's not beyond the scope of our historical reality to see acculturation and indoctrination. It's happened frequently. So let's take a more blatant look, a step further, if you will, about Hitler Youth in World War II. It was a direct and pervasive ideological infiltration of schools. In 1933, there were 50,000 members of Hitler Youth, and by the end of that year, the number had eclipsed to 2 million. By 1939, 6 years later, over 90% of German kids were a part of Hitler Youth. And it was a ploy to get ideology into the children and into the home. Hitler Youth in Germany were taught Nazi ideology, racial superiority, anti-Semitism, militarism, and what's concerning, blind obedience to authority, along with Boy Scouting skills. And they tried to use what was familiar in order to acculturate the kids to this thing. Seriously, let's talk for a second. Stop right there. What would you do if a small Nazi Boy Scout showed up at your door? Are you buying cookies from them? Let me know. I would like to understand your rationale for this. Okay, we'll move on now. Here in the U.S., a very different force of influence is afoot. Much less lethal in terms of war fighting, but nevertheless insidious. In 1903, John D. Rockefeller founded the General Education Board. And before it shut down in 1964, it gave millions to further education in America. It helped to rescue schools from desperate circumstances, however, only within a certain context due to the influence that they held as donors. So arguably, because they were feeding the school money, the patrons of that school felt a duty to uphold what they were asked to do by this power. They had a legitimate foothold in the places that they funded. GB faced persistent allegations of excluding minorities, Jim Crow, and instead of advocating for equal opportunities for all kids, it advocated for vocational training for the folks who couldn't attend college. And at first, that doesn't sound so bad. You think those people are getting vocational training to take care of themselves and their families. But maybe the problem with this will be a little bit more evident upon evaluating a quote from other GB founders. So first, oil tycoon John D. Rockefeller, one of the founders I just mentioned, got himself mistakenly saddled with the quote, "I don't want a nation of thinkers, I want a nation of workers." And I actually heard that somewhere. I thought that was pretty messed up. But it actually arose from a 2006 documentary, One Nation Under Siege. I watched like 10 minutes of it, and it's like an old school take on how democracy is threatened when the government is reacting to terrorism. Anyway, we can't concretely link the sentiments to a quote by Rockefeller, but we can link it to one of his key advisors, another close associate who was instrumental in founding the General Education Board. In fact, this associate, Frederick Taylor Gates, actually wrote something about this in his 1916 book, The Country School of Tomorrow. He specifically writes, "We shall not try to make these people or any of their children philosophers or men of learning or men of science. We have not to raise up from among them authors, editors, poets, or men of letters. We shall not search for great artists, painters, musicians, nor lawyers, doctors, preachers, politicians, statesmen, of whom we have ample supply." Clearly very exclusive. And then he continues to say, "The task we set before ourselves is very simple as well as a very beautiful one. To train these people as we find them to a perfectly ideal life just where they are. So we'll organize our children into a little community and teach them to do in a perfect way the things their fathers and mothers are doing in the homes, in the shops, and on the farm." So a few things become clear here in his writing. There's a definite exclusivity of learning and knowing even. Country folk who are busy taking care of their family and trying to put food on the table are not going to be paying attention to this man's writings. So they're not going to know that the founder of the General Education Board, who is likely helping their school, is actually preventing their child potentially from getting more opportunities. And then on top of that, you want to keep those people educated but ignorant. So educated, but not enough to ask more questions or ask for potential opportunities. And yes, I know none of this has even touched on mythology, but we'll trust the process and I'll get you there. So back to the education system and indoctrination. After the end of World War II, the U.S. attempted to indoctrinate Nazi kids in white American schools. In 1946 and 47, Operation Paperclip brought over numerous German scientists to assist with missile development and even the space program, including Nazi missile developer Wernher von Braun. And the 144 children of these scientists also went to public school in El Paso and were touted as propaganda themselves. So here we have a situation where a poor set of kids is being saddled with two vastly different sets of propaganda. Like, were some of them wearing a cowboy hat, waving an American flag, eating a hot dog, and they were just saying Heil Hitler like a few years before they moved? Maybe it happened like psychologist John Barry's model, in which we have four options when met with a new cultural exposure of indoctrination. We have assimilation, like the Borg, resistance is futile. Adopt the dominant culture and exclude your own. You have integration, which is maintaining your own culture while participating in the dominant culture. Separation, like oil and water. And then you just have straight marginalization, where you're so jarred from this exposure and so disengaged that you became disengaged from the dominant culture in addition to your own. And all of this happens in four stages. So you have the initial cultural contact, then you potentially go through culture shock, you start to acquire the new language, and then there are changes in the individual identities and intergroup relations because of this exposure. The degree to which this acculturation happens is based upon what's valued by the individual and by the community. Is it more valuable to integrate or to separate? To resist altogether? Is it safe to do either one of those things? And I wonder what those kids felt like. I mean, they didn't ask to be born into a war. They didn't ask to be programmed or exposed to propaganda. They didn't ask for any type of culture shock. But we also didn't ask to be programmed. And now with that small bit of information that we've just built, the foundation that we can grow upon, we can return to the concepts of myth and layer it with new meaning. Mythologies, theologies, any kind of dogmatic belief, propaganda, they're all types of visions and storytelling that have, in a way, prompted behavioral shifts, changes in cultural values and attitudes. And in this way, they're extremely powerful. One myth, one story can be enough to control the masses and their perception of the world. And here we return to where we began. Myths derive from the Greek word mythos, meaning story or word. And there are many different types of myth, but we'll just try to focus on a few concepts for time-saving purposes. From a mythopoetic perspective, myths are a kind of movement for humanity to use poetry and storytelling to reach a self-understanding. The Greek word mythopoeia basically means utterance or tale, where we're weaving together our conceptions of the world. In a mythopoetic worldview, it's not fully scientific, but it is concrete and it's personified. There isn't some kind of identification of patterns or fixed universal law. Maybe, for example, the sea swelled with rage or refused to rise, just like I wanted to refuse to rise when it was time to go to school. And it's here where we begin to hone in on things. Etiological myths are stories that seek to explain why something is the way that it is. So lightning and thunder can be explained by an angry Zeus. This applies to etymology as well. So for the origin of Aphrodite, her name is derived from Aphros, which was sea foam, so they said she was born of the sea. Even religious rites of passage, like the Greek rituals of the Eleusinian Mysteries, they explained their existence by saying Demeter visited Eleusis and taught these people how to worship her. These are probably the most familiar kinds of myths to all of you, especially the angry Zeus. But there are some other categories that we definitely should take note of as we navigate through this new world in a mythological lens. Aside from historical myths like the Iliad and Odyssey, the psychological myths that explain how we feel the way we feel and why, the powerful forces of emotion that influence human behavior, we need to take note of some other mythological constructs. Amongst the concrete, albeit emotional, etiological myths, and the psychological tapestry of our stories, our self-conceptions, remains the concept of functional myth. These myths specifically teach humanity notions of morality and social behavior. Functional myths convey, through storytelling, all of the do's and don'ts of existing in proximity to others within a given social context, and they also highlight the consequences of doing the wrong things. For example, Medusa minding her own business and probably getting assaulted in a temple but being blamed for it and then being cursed with snakes on her head. Can you imagine? Wait, ugh, I should have got the clown nose. Can you imagine that you're Medusa standing there minding your own business and some lightning firecracker person approaches you and you just don't even know what to do with yourself? Like, why is this man talking to me? What does he want? And then you realize he's married and that his wife is vengeful and that you're about to have hair for snakes. I'm so sorry, Medusa, that you got the blame. That was a weird rant. Okay, back to regularly scheduled programming. Imagine just how powerful functional myths can be within this context. Imagine what could happen when the tool of functional myth is wielded by corruptible human beings. A politician, a preacher, a school teacher, an entire community. all of these people potentially can shape the worldviews of our youth and of all of us. And it's due to the stories of functional myth, stories of what dictate what's right and wrong and the consequences of those actions. And perhaps Freudian thoughts made these notions more dangerous for the autonomy of the free-thinking person. Freud agreed that myths were vague wish dreams of people. Mythology was the place of symbolic meeting, and it expressed the conflict and wishes of the unconscious mind. But more poignantly, he argued to the masses that within the human mind was a disruptive and repressed primitive being. Hence all of those Freudian slips. But what do you take away from both of these arguments when put together? Freud delegitimizes the relevance of myth in daily life with the spread of his ideas, helping to place overall cognizance of the impact of myth on the back burner, because it's just a daydream, it's not important. And on top of that, he sort of gives those in control, at least those aligned with his teachings, a reason, a mechanism of control over people, even potential suppression in the future. And this is because through his lens, people are primitive and disruptive by nature. What better way to control them than to control the narratives that shape their thoughts? And they could do this with Freudian justifications, without the public being aware or even able to weigh in. And perhaps Freudian thoughts made these notions more dangerous for the autonomy of the free-thinking person. Freud agreed that myths were vague wish dreams of people. Mythology was the place of symbolic meeting, and it expressed the conflict and wishes of the unconscious mind. But more poignantly, he argued to the masses that within the human mind was a disruptive and repressed primitive being. Hence all of those Freudian slips. But what do you take away from both of these arguments when put together? Freud delegitimizes the relevance of myth in daily life with the spread of his ideas, helping to place overall cognizance of the impact of myth on the back burner, because it's just a daydream, it's not important. And on top of that, he sort of gives those in control, at least those aligned with his teachings, a reason, a mechanism of control over people, even potential suppression in the future. And this is because through his lens, people are primitive and disruptive by nature. What better way to control them than to control the narratives that shape their thoughts? And they could do this with Freudian justifications, without the public being aware or even able to weigh in. And this wasn't the first time that the masses wouldn't be able to weigh in on the mythological narrative. Let's talk about heresy, the Inquisition, the Catholic Church, and the purposeful limitation of stories of biblical myths in the Bible that have shaped the worldview of our public today. Heresy derives from heresis, which in Latin, it's a transliteration of a Greek word meaning choosing, choice, or course of action. And that's exactly what heresy was. It was a choice of certain parties in the church to include or exclude stories and teachings based upon their subjective rejection or adherence to certain teachings or dogma. By the end of the first century, it came time to delineate. At this time, Nicene Christianity became the official religion of the Roman Empire. It brought status, property, history, and influence. It was a reality of competing doctrines, is what it was. And in many regions, it's important to note that these doctrines considered heretical were more like the original manifestations of Christianity. These texts were actually widely in circulation before the King James. An edict of Theodosius II set a precedent for giving severe punishment to spreading writings that were deemed heretical. And they were writings that argued about the divinity or humanity of Christ. It was nothing that was of danger to anyone. In fact, if you go to look at the King James, Revelations 22:18-19 actually says not to add or subtract from Scripture, but it seems like the church completely ignored that. They already removed 23 books by the Council of Nicaea in 325. Books were burned by several Roman emperors who were part of the church, including Constantine. They wanted to create canon law, in a uniform dogmatic story that people would adhere to and believe. A story where Jesus was a savior rather than a master or a prophet. A myth where Eve was the temptation and downfall of man. A story where the Garden of Eden was a safe haven. And a myth that we were cast out because we ate a forbidden fruit. Sounds pretty Freudian if you ask me. There were 7 ecumenical councils between 325 and 787, held as a discussion between factions to solidify and unite many stories and viewpoints into one big biblical myth. The councils themselves weren't even universally recognized by each party. Sometimes councils were held with a seemingly intentional exclusion of others. And then the Inquisition came to the forefront by 800 to 1299 in the High Middle Ages, with deaths averaging more than 40,000 people per year. Dominican and Franciscan monks became like extensions of the Pope to inquire about and suppress heresy. The use of torture to extract confessions became approved by Innocent IV in 1252. And there was a reason to put so much violence and undertake so much effort into crafting a specific mythology for the Bible. Aside from religion, aside from heresy, these ideals, these alternate mythologies may have posed a threat to papal balances and influence. The more people you have believing in your mythology, the more your coffers are filled. The Holy See, or governing body of the Vatican, has been generating money since the 8th century through Peter's pence. It even sold indulgences between the 1300s and the 1500s. Money and capital bought them a great deal of political influence as well. In fact, in some ways, maybe a great deal of mythology goes back to political influence. But we'll save that for another time. Our next episode is going to delve way further into the mythology and theology itself, now that we've seen the setup. We're going to talk all about the misinformation that's been circulating about the Garden of Eden, about Eve, and about all of the other key players in that story. Newsflash, Eve wasn't as bad as they made her out to be, and perhaps the garden was more insidious. See you next time!